Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up with all of our latest and oldest podcasts, I suppose. We most recently talked about 12 Angry Men. Before that was Colossal and War Machine. And I've also written a bunch of things that you can check out on the website as well. And our next podcast will be about John Carpenter's The Thing, so you can check that out when we release it. Let's get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
And that was Paul Simon's 2017 hit Baby Podcaster, which he re-recorded for us with no Art Garfunkel. So, bonus points.
That was his request.
That was everybody but Art Garfunkel's request. Actually, Garfunkel wanted out of the group too, but that's because he's a tool. The only cool person that ever liked Art Garfunkel is Mike Nichols. Anyways, moving on. We're talking about Baby Driver.
Are we?
Like, there's going to be a lot of Simon and Garfunkel tangents, and people are just going to have to embrace that. Okay. Simon and Garfunkel and Run the Jewels are featured prominently in this film, so it's gonna happen at some point that I'm going to start talking about these things.
Alex's musical love.
My two favorite musical duos of all time. Could not be more similar.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't going to take long before we got to the music discussing Baby Driver, though.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, named after a song and also built around songs. So,
yeah, and I think Edgar Wright did one of your favorite things to do before a movie is made, which is send a soundtrack around.
Did he do that?
Yeah,
I didn't know that, but that's not in the least bit shocking.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's been talked about a lot lately, but this is an idea he's had for a long time. This is an idea he used to make a music video several years ago,
which is a fantastic music video. I think it's by Mint Royale, called Blue Song, I think. Anyway,
yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of like the first bit of Baby Driver that we see Baby just in the car waiting for a heist to happen. It's just him kind of dancing along to the music and dancing with his wipers, and just a fun song, you know, being enjoyed while there's some horrific things happening.
Yeah, exactly. Nearby. Yeah, also just in general, a music video about a heist where the heist is mostly ignored, you know?
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah. But as we said, the music is just so central to this movie. The title, obviously, as you stated, a massive soundtrack. Like, it looked like the visual effects department of a Marvel movie when they show the soundtrack of this movie. Like, it's just so incredible, the amount of different songs and different artists and the different genres that are chosen for this. And
I mean, even score, I've definitely one piece of score from another film, and I would guess a couple others that I just didn't recognize.
Right. And I mean, that's to say that this is something that's been ruminating with Edgar Wright for a long time, to do a movie like this. And you and I will get to, as we said, this is going to be a very contentious podcast. You and I will get to some more analysis of, you know, stories and performances and things like that. But I think it's pretty undeniable that anybody who saw this has to admit that there's just an incredible level of detail gone into this movie, and clearly someone, at least one person, has been thinking about this for a very long time.
Yeah, for sure. And if an interview on the Comedy Bang Bang podcast is to be trusted, they did a storyboarding for every shot of this movie, which I do not believe at all. But I believe it for the action sequences. I don't believe that happened for a lot of the dialogue scenes, but the action sequences were just so dependent on timing that they would basically, the editor would be on set timing out the shot. And it's like, does this work in the cut with the song that we have already decided will be used for this portion of the film? And that's the type of detail that we're talking about. And like, whether or not the gunshots on Tequila are coming at the right time, and all of these little things. And And in editing as well, just other even smaller things that don't necessarily jump out at you when, you know, the easiest thing to describe is the opening credit sequence where we're just sort of seeing the hearing elements of the world around Baby that are just sort of playing along with the song, like the woman at the ATM hitting her pin number with the beat, and just about 5 to 10 other perfect examples, not to mention the lyrics that are written on telephone poles and walls
graffiti
around
on walls.
I mean, that opening credit sequence is goddamn amazing. Like,
yeah, and I mean, this was not Edgar Wright's idea to ever edit an action scene to music. You know, that's pretty common practice. That's not unusual at all. But the level that they do it to within the action scenes, and as you said, the the way that they do that outside. Yeah, I don't agree that some of these conversations where they're planning the heist are storyboarded to music, and that all of those, every bit of action or dialogue, doesn't have a relation to a beat or something like that. But yeah, that opening scene, which is, you know, I think one of the better scenes in the whole movie, it's so clearly true of that. And that's what I think, not just the level of songs, but the minutia that, like, you have to focus on to have a coffee run seem propulsive and interesting, and that dependent on the music, I think is a definite strength of this movie. And something that when people talk about it being really original, or people saying it's something, you know, different than you've seen before, I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the best way to describe the level of detail in the action sequences and how, you know, they're timing out shots and storyboarded all of the shots beforehand, and, you know, how long they had for each shot to take. The best way to describe that is to say they edited the movie before they shot it, you know? And that's the easiest way to describe it, even though it's, you know, impossible, an impossible thing to actually do. That is the basically the approach they took to these scenes, and it shows, you know?
Yeah, to have someone on set timing, you know, marks and the finger pulling a trigger, that's, yeah, as you said, that's pretty much editing beforehand.
Yeah, for sure. And it's kind of like, I mean, I wouldn't have been sitting around watching The World's End thinking about the next logical step for Edgar Wright, but it does sort of feel like the next logical step for Edgar Wright in his filmmaking, in that the best things about his style have always been the connective tissue. Like, nobody shoots better cut like insert shots and transitions from scene to scene than Edgar Wright. And as somebody that has consistently been disappointed by the films that he makes, just because I think he's so talented, and there just hasn't, at least not since Shaun of the Dead, there hasn't been a movie that has sort of lived up to the level of talent that he has, I think has been consistently frustrating to me. Like, if you watch the first 20 minutes of Scott Pilgrim versus the World, it's like just perfect filmmaking. It's so good. And then the movie like devolves into fight after fight, and it just gets impossibly boring. But just the way that he is able to tie scenes together and keep things very kinetic, and just the level of detail in a lot of the insert shots, and the way that the camera's always moving a little bit to get some of these shots, or it's a perfectly framed extreme close-up. All of these things are the things that Edgar Wright's the best at, and this movie basically tried to turn most of the movie into those things, you know?
It is interesting to think of it as his career progression. You know, he's been someone who really liked to play with genre convention, and this one, I mean, for the original things it does provide, and, you know, some winks at the camera, I think it is pretty straightforward, don't you?
The movie itself?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm always kind of happy to see a director prove he can do something else, and, you know, this isn't an insanely expensive movie, but the fact that he had the control that he had and the budget that he had, and chose to do something else, you know, you just wouldn't want to see him take up some other genre and kind of spoof it with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost again. So I guess I was expecting a bit more, you know, playing with conventions. I was hoping not to the same degree, but I thought there'd be a bit more fun with what the action genre is or has become, and it wasn't there, but I think for him to kind of step out further as someone who can handle just a bigger picture and make a movie that a lot of people like, which he undoubtedly has done here, is just, I think that's great for a pretty young filmmaker to be able to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but you kind of thought there was a bit of it at least, or you think it's...
Of like playing with the action movies genre conventions?
Yeah.
Not so much. It's just the whole movie is basically, it's been made. It's The Driver, the Walter Hill movie, which is also a fantastic movie. But, it's also been made in 2011 where it was Drive, which was also very obviously inspired by Walter Hill's The Driver, And Walter Hill is in this movie very briefly.
Yeah.
It's been made before and will be made again. And I will see it again, and I will enjoy it, because it's just, I don't know, if you make a crime movie that has a few jokes in it that are legitimately good, and it's just a wonderfully executed action movie, I'm gonna love it. As a genre, it just works for me. And I didn't come out of this movie thinking I wish there had been more conventions played with, just because I guess I don't look at Edgar Wright that way. Like, you're not wrong, obviously. He's built his career on playing with genre conventions, and his before this movie, his favorite movie of mine was a movie that was all genre, playing with genre conventions. But yeah, I didn't leave this movie thinking I wish Baby Driver had winked at the camera more,
yeah. What do you think of the Drive comparison?
I just think this movie and Drive are very similar. It's just, this is sort of a more comedic version of it.
Okay, I do, but tonally, I find them so different.
Tonally, very different, but as far as the basic plot of the movie, they're very similar.
Yeah,
and very simple movies directed by very talented directors who turn them into something more than they could have been. Yeah,
with a lead male driver who doesn't talk very much.
Yeah, that's true.
I didn't think they gave Ansel a lot to say, but I don't think he did much with what he had.
Yeah, I like this movie a lot. We'll get the bad stuff out of the way right off the top. This guy fucking sucks. He is a terrible actor. He's garbage. Like, the second that John Spencer, what's that? What's that? John Spencer Blues Explosion or whatever the fuck that band's called. Once that song starts and he starts dancing in the car and doing the yells or whatever, immediately I was like, oh no, this is bad. And this is in minute one of the movie, and nothing that I saw after that convinced me of anything otherwise. And it's just a bummer because he's so bad, like just terrible. And my theory on this is that and Edgar Wright would never say something like this. I think he's in this movie because he gets this movie made, because he brings in the groups of teenage girls that have been at every one of my screenings because of The Fault in Our Stars. I mean, maybe Edgar Wright actually likes him as a performer, because part of this is on Edgar Wright in that he didn't kibosh that terrible accent that Elgort's doing the whole movie. And that's a choice that comes
for
down
some of that movie, at least.
Sorry?
I find the accent is much more present at times than others.
Fair enough. Just if your actor can't do an accent, don't do an accent. You know who can do an accent? Lily James. So she does an American accent, with the exception of like one hello where it's very obvious that she's British. But just in general, he sucks, and everything else about this movie is fantastic. And like I think he brings this movie down so much because he makes the scenes, I think the scenes with him and Deb are just not good, despite the fact that I think Lily James is fantastic in this movie. I just get bored in those scenes because I just hate him and cannot wait for him to not talk, and everybody else in this movie is so good, every other performance.
I think to touch on what you said about maybe Edgar Wright's feelings about it, maybe it was pressure by the studio and not his idea to do that. And
what do you mean, to cast Elgort?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I believe that 100%.
And I think that in the interviews, the reasons he does talk about why he likes him is that, he's got a background in dance and music. And I think the scenes where, you know, he's dancing or kind of doing things physically, I think work very well. Now, maybe that's a combination of some good cinematography and some good choreography and some good musical choices and some great editing. But I still found that, you know, those scenes to be engaging and not, you know, I think that, you know, that's different than acting, but I didn't dislike him in those scenes. And then we get those scenes where he does have to talk and he does have to emote and he does have to pretend to speak with an American dialect. And yeah, I just come right back to the same thing of being let down. It would be such a cool showcase for a young actor too. You know, they're not asking a ton of you, but there's some great moments. And yeah, I'll agree with you for the most part that it's just such a letdown.
Yeah, and yes, I will agree that what he's doing in some of the scenes is very difficult, and the more dancery scenes specifically. But yeah, I don't know. Give me somebody this is the Gosling question from La La Land. Give me somebody that's a slightly less dancer or less talented dancer that I do not like, or sorry, that I actually like. You know,
oh, imagine you had to do dancing scenes in Drive too.
You didn't see the extended cut. It ends the exact same way as Slumdog Millionaire. All the dead characters come back to life and they do a big dance number. It's very bizarre.
I think you and I might have the same opinion about the scenes with Deborah then. I think Lily James is good at what she does in this movie, but I just don't think there's much to that character. And I think that the emotional stuff about this movie, it just really doesn't land with me. And I think that's one of the bigger things that it takes us down from being a great movie. There's just some things that miss, and as undeniably great as some of the filmmaking is in this movie,
the casting is equally undeniably poor at times.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, one flaw in the cast, I guess. Yep,
it's all sense.
Yeah, I mean, we've got, like, for women, you know, we've got Deborah, who we've talked about, who we think, you know, does what she can with what she's given, but the scenes just don't emotionally connect. That's fair to say for you too as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then,
but I want to make it very clear, I think Lily James is very good in this film. Anyway, continue.
Yes, okay. Yeah. And then we have Darling, Yala Gonzalez.
Okay.
So I'm good with that pronunciation. Who, you know, if you're going to talk about hitting the demographics by bringing the girls, she kind of is forced to do all the sexual heavy lifting on this movie. And, you know, we can't have Deborah James do it because she's our stand-in for Baby's mom, so we can't sexualize her. And then we don't really get much from Baby's mom just because she's dead by the time this movie starts. So we get brief flashbacks with no dialogue, just a bit of singing. Yeah, it doesn't do well in the Bechdel test, and I think just emotionally, like, it really doesn't click for me, their love scenes, and even just outside of their love scenes, I think if you want to get the bad stuff out of the way, I think that the plot and character motivations also kind of get muddied, and I think that's one of the few missteps this movie makes as well.
Yep, I can agree with that.
And being pretty top heavy, I think by the end, as things are muddied, the John Hamm stuff seems kind of nonsensical, and the scene goes on a little bit too long. I think it's just one of the worst action scenes, and to culminate with that, I think is damaging to the overall film as well.
I kind of I disagree with that. I think that's a good, very good sequence.
Yeah, I just think the first heist is so good, like, or the first chase.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, that's definitely the best driving in the movie. I don't necessarily think that's the best action piece in the movie. I think the foot race is amazing, and Tequila is definitely my favorite action scene in the movie.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It's so good. And it's like maybe 45 seconds long, you know, but it's just, I don't know, it just comes out of nowhere, feels like it comes out of nowhere, and is over, like, before you have a second to register what's happening, and then they break down to that conversation, the swirling steady cam shot, and then we get like a reprieve of the action scene, and oh man, the tequila sequence is so good. And that's... I feel outside of like some of the difficult wide driving shots, I feel like that must have been the most difficult thing to do, because there are so many people firing guns in that scene, and so many people firing guns on time in that scene, that yeah. On musical time, that it must have just been a nightmare.
Yeah, and just so many more people in frame simultaneously, and to get to get good action like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've talked about kind of liking the geography of action scenes, and I think this movie does a really good job of that when it comes to the, you know, the shootouts and to the driving sequences as well. You know, we've talked about enjoying the Bourne sequences very much, but this chase sequences, this kind of has a different approach of, you know, wider shots and more things in frame and fewer cuts. Although obviously there are a ton of cuts at certain points on the music, but I think this just gives it more space to appreciate what they did.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree. And I think that said, I think that it, you know, that stuff isn't flawless. I think there are some car chase growing pains that happen in this movie, but they're very, I don't know, like there were just a couple moments where, you know, you cut from one shot where the camera's small in the right side of the frame, and then you cut to a close up. Like a medium shot of the car, or the medium shot equivalent of a shot of a car, on the left side of the frame, and just like little things that I feel like, if there's a Baby Driver dose, that would be smoothed out, just because I'm sure Edgar Wright sees those things and is like, I could do this better. But those are minor, so minor that I can't even recall exactly what scene that is, but yeah. I remember that jumping out at me.
Yeah, and I really enjoy the just near the end of that first chase sequence when he's driving around those trucks that are all at the loading bay, and he does kind of a fishtail around, and then, you know, clearly hits the brakes and swerves around the last one. Like, it's this big long S, and it's done from a bird's eye view, and just, you know, a pretty long one, I mean, for a car chase.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is kind of our intro to the movie, and that got me really excited about it, and just that choice to do it that way from that distance and that length of a shot, yeah, just made me very excited for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, let's talk about the rest of the cast, I guess, because I mean I guess we're just kind of running down the names of people that we think were fantastic in this movie, but
did we do Ansel yet?
No. I mean, we can redo that one if you want.
No, I think you made your
feelings. He's so bad, I wish Art Garfunkel had played Baby Driver. So, Dr. Spaceman, Kevin Spacey, obviously fantastic. It also just hasn't been in a movie in a while. Or, sorry, he was in that, like, Talking Cat movie that was directed by Barry Sonnenfeld last summer that looked, like, all-time nuts. But, yeah, like...
Nine lives, show it respect.
Okay, I'm so sorry. So sorry to everybody involved with that paycheck of a film.
By Ansel Elgort.
Yeah, it's the Ansel Elgort of movies. Yeah, he's basically just been playing Frank Underwood for 4 years, with very small exceptions. And it's good to see Spaceman in a movie again. John Hamm's obviously fantastic, and
yeah, Kevin Spacey keeps it nice and calm. You know, the dad's angry indoor voice. I've seen his performance described in this one. I think that's pretty spot on.
Yeah, but he also does have to convey a sense of menace, which I just think is something that he is able to do is pretty like really well. I mean, consistently throughout his career, when he's had to play menacing, he does it pretty well, which is also, you know, more difficult given that he is not, like, say, John Hamm is like a physically, could be a physically threatening looking person, right? Whereas Kevin Spacey just looks like a dad, you know? And
yeah, no, but I think that's what I mean. Like, you know, when you have Kevin Spacey and you need him to be menacing, you don't need him to break one of his own henchmen's neck in his opening scene to prove that he's probably unhinged, even though he's very good at keeping calm.
Yeah, and I think that's probably just constant. He's just benefited from some real Usual Suspects hangover for the past 25 years. It's just like that's a character built around knowing he's not the villain, or believing that he's not the villain, and then it turns out he did all of these horrible things, and I think maybe that's just followed him throughout his career. Yeah.
Reverse spoiler alert for Usual Suspects.
Over 25 years old, it's fine.
And I mean that works, because when he does get violent, it's surprising. You know, it is near the end of the film, when he actually starts killing people, and he does it for Baby, and you kind of had the idea that as things are ratcheting up, there's going to be more violence and more people involved, but for him to have kind of played it so cool but still menacing up until that point, I think helps.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, then John Hamm.
Very handsome person. Yeah.
Very handsome, even when deranged and bloody.
Yeah, no, he's good in this movie as well. I would say less of a Hamm fanatic than you, but I think what he does is good. Yeah. I think it's yeah. also just very much in his wheelhouse. John Hamm does not put on an accent because John Hamm doesn't knows that he can't do an accent.
Well, that's good.
His accents then, sound like the Reverend in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah. And then your boy Bats.
Yeah, I really like Jamie Foxx in this movie because I think like as an actor, like in some of the more, you know, Oscar baity dramas that he's been in, he's not as good as people think he is, I think. But in this type of movie where, because he's overqualified for this role, just like Spaceman and Hamm. Like, John Hamm's probably slightly overqualified for his role, and same with Spaceman. But I feel like Jamie Foxx, I don't know, if you cast this movie 10 times, you know, and there's never anybody more famous than Jamie Foxx playing the hit Bats, you know, just because he's, I don't know, there's something about the level of fame that he has that is kind of surprising that he plays this role, and that adds something to the movie because, you know, when your, I guess, third lead, or third or fourth, maybe, lead is as talented.
Fourth on the call sheet.
Okay. Well, fourth on the call sheet. If you have somebody as talented as Jamie Foxx, fourth on your call sheet, that's pretty amazing, you know?
Yeah.
Having him number one isn't necessarily a movie I'm going to love, but having him number four, like, you're swimming in riches, you know? Although, I guess one of those is basically a negative 10 in numero uno Ansel Elgort. But, but yeah, I just think he's overqualified for the role that he has, which I mean as a compliment because I think he's fantastic for the movie. You know,
could upgrade John Bernthal to that role.
Oh man, I would have loved to see more John Bernthal. He's so clearly
too, for some reason.
Sorry,
I always liked him too for some reason.
Yeah, he's so clearly in the movie because he was. I mean, he's good in everything. Everybody always likes him, but he's so clearly in this movie because he was just shooting something else in Atlanta. Like, there's nothing that gives me any indication of anything otherwise, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. With Jamie Foxx, you know, he gets to spread his wings a bit, you know, be menacing, be funny, be dangerous. So
all yeah, these are all
stuff to do for, as you said, not a ton of screen time given who he is.
Exactly, he's playing the terrifying muscle, but you know, again, overqualified to do so, and that elevates the movie, I think, and definitely elevates his scenes, you know.
And we both agreed we didn't like Lily James at all.
I feel so bad for her.
Tried to sneak one past you there.
Yeah. Can't do it. Won't happen.
She's got like a 1990s Gina Davis vibe going, so you know I'm on board.
Well,
I mean that sincerely.
Now I'm no longer on board. Yeah, I don't know. So what did you take out of his use of an iPod as opposed to aside from the fact that he's given an iPod by his parents, but that specific iPod doesn't work. Did you put any thought to him using a music device that's not a phone other than he just can't really have a GPS on him?
I mean, yeah, I guess he always has the burners. That's true. I didn't even think of that. No, I mean, I think it's funny to think of this as something of a retro music device at this point, but it's not crazy at all, right? Like, I know they still sell iPods, and that his was...
They don't sell the iPod Classic. It's been discontinued for 3 or 4 years.
Right, that's what I was just going to say. I know that one is one that's not really in production anymore. Still got the wheel and all that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I liked it a lot for some reason. I liked him having the different ones. I think that's really funny. Mm-hmm. And... no, I don't know if I have a hot take on it other than, you know, he's a millennial and retro's cool, but what did you think?
Well, I just enjoy the way that the movie, I don't have any sort of, like, that's something that jumped out at me because I wish I still had a functioning iPod Classic because, I think it was a fantastic device that, helped improve my life. Quite a bit, and I don't always think that about technology. And I just kind of miss having a separate music device. The thing that I thought about the most as it pertained to the iPod is just the way that he's just always drowning something, like drowning out the world, right? And as somebody that wears headphones, I mean, you've known me for my, like a long period of time, and the number of times you've seen me in public without headphones is probably very small. And
every time we do this podcast,
well, yeah, also that that's more practical than trying to. And it, but like when you're wearing headphones outside, it's because you're consciously deciding I like what I can choose to hear better than the sounds of reality, right? And that's what I see a lot in Baby Driver is him taking this thing that was given to him as a present from his parents, and then he is drowning out the bad things in life. You know, before they get in the car accident, he's drowning out his parents' arguments. And after his parents' arguments, he's drowning out the side effect of that accident that he was in, you know, the tinnitus. He's just constantly covering things up. And he really feels like somebody that hasn't engaged with a lot of people in the movie. Like, so many things in this movie are, I think we're supposed to believe, are happening for the first time, you know. It doesn't totally make sense that Darling and Buddy would be on two heists so closely together, so close together to me, you know. Just like Baby sometimes seems way too confident, and then has to be all like shy when he's talking to Deb. I don't know. There's a weird ever-changing scale of his level of confidence, I find. But
yeah.
But the thing that I like the most about this movie is when he starts engaging with people outside of the world of his headphones and outside of the world of crime that he's working in, is that when he's talking to Deb, probably in their first scene together, and he says it. Deborah is the name of a song by Trex, right? Which is him mispronouncing T-Rex, and shows that he just hasn't had an opportunity in his life to talk about Mark Bolan to anybody. Yeah.
He's only read that word, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought that was a fantastic little moment to have in the movie. And also just the way that the people that he does sort of identify with, he does through music, right? He so quickly falls for Deb because they're talking about music, and it's like, oh, I can talk to somebody about these things that I thought existed only in my head. And and I really enjoy that as something that keeps the movie going. And part of the reason he seems so empathetic towards the post office worker is because she quotes Dolly Parton, which is a very nice scene. And also she is fantastic in this movie with having very little to do. And I just thought the way that he uses music to both drown out the world and then also engage with parts of the world, I think was interesting. Yeah,
because it's so central to his character, and it's also so central to this movie, right? Just the idea that he is this movie in such a literal way. And yeah, I think it's important that he's not, you know, this movie is, I'm assuming, present day, right?
Yeah, we get, nobody ever specifically tells us otherwise.
Yeah, but it feels like it. And yeah, you know, he has his iPod, which doesn't connect to anything else. You know, what's a more modern symbol of connectivity than, or a certain kind of connectivity than a smartphone, right? Something with Wi-Fi or internet access, to be constantly connected to anybody who wants to reach you. And that's not how he does it. You know, he listens to these iPods. There's nothing's going to come through those earbuds except the music that he chooses, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly, you know, there's obviously financial reasons why your burner is not a great phone, but it's just kind of this thing that's closed off. We see him several times not answer a phone, you know, in that scene you're talking about with Deborah. It buzzes, you know, it vibrates away from him. You don't see the screen, you don't see the number, but you know who it is. And he just chooses not to invite that into his life. And he's always got the music going. He's always got some connectivity to music, but he has a phone that, you know, he answers when he wants to. He, you know, it doesn't have a screen that you can see who's calling. He's very, very specific about how he operates with that technology, and very very reluctant to answer it sometimes. But the phone is the music through the iPod is such a constant, and I think it's, you know, these two different items. There's this one that allows people to contact you about anything, and then there's the one that you have absolute control over. You put the music on and you hit play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sorry, were you gonna say something?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Just like, and another thing that I like as you know, as the movie continues. And I guess the reason I feel like this movie doesn't run out of steam, whereas other people seem to, I think more people agree with you than me.
As is typical.
Okay, great. but just the way that I guess maybe I'm spending more time tracking his media consumption, because I am somebody that's very interested in media consumption. But, you know, there are more scenes in the second half of this movie where he's not wearing headphones, right? And part of the reason is that we see this slow build of him sort of starting to realize that maybe he's drowning out things he shouldn't be drowning out, and that there's a little bit of willful ignorance on his part. You know, like when other people run inside to perform this heist, he puts on the John Spencer Blues Explosion, or again, I'm sorry if I'm getting that band name wrong, but it's a goofy name. I know that.
You're at least 75% right.
Yeah.
Spencer might be wrong, but I'm confident about the rest.
I feel like Spencer's right. I was wondering if maybe it's Jazz Explosion. Anyway, these are things we could easily check, but
we will not.
We'll refuse. He's, you know, he puts on this music, presumably at a very, very high volume, and then just looks away from what's happening. And people may or may not be getting shot in that bank in the beginning. People are definitely getting killed later on. And it's that second heist, the Soldier Boy heist, where he pulls the car forward out of the view so he can't see what's happening, and then goes back and sees the guy's head bleeding. And that's the first moment we start to see him being like, maybe what I'm doing, you know, isn't good. I mean, I'm sure if he ever thought about it, he'd be like, this is obviously bad. I'm a criminal. And as the movie progresses, we get more and more examples of him starting to, you know, fight back against his world. And a lot of times those scenes happen when he is not wearing headphones, you know, and like when he's trying to get away from you know, the 2 a.m. he's going to pick up Deb for the road trip at 2 a.m. He, you know, he's not listening to headphones then, because, you know, he has to pay attention to the world because he's actively fighting back against it.
Yeah, yeah, no, and I think there's that idea that he has to listen to it because listen to the world because there are threats coming. But I think part of that also ties in with Dr. Spaceman, known as Doc in this movie,
For short.
Yeah, his speech saying, you know, one day you're going to realize you have blood on your hands. I forget the exact lines, but his removal of the headphones, I think, is partially to get away from the maxim of hear no evil, do no evil, right? Like he, as you said, he pulls up at that heist because there's a good chance he's going to see something he doesn't want to feel he's part of. And that's just his way of dealing with people, is to kind of block people out with music. And his way of dealing with what he does in the world and what he does for money is to pretend he's not a part of it. And, you know, part of his journey is realizing that when you drive armed people to a place that ends up being a murder scene 2 minutes later, then yeah, you, and then you drive them away and hide them from the police, that you are complicit in this. And you can kind of say Doc's making you do it, but then that goes away at a certain point, to an extent at least. And we see it with glasses all the time. You know, we saw it with Out of Sight. There's just a point where ignorance is bliss no longer works out, and that if you're going to accept what you do and who you are as an extension of that, you have to own up for what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And towards the end of the movie, like the very end of the movie, once him and Deb are actually like on the road together, driving away, you know, up until he gets arrested, he doesn't have headphones for the rest of the movie, right? And so, like he to quote unquote, you know, the term of you know, facing what you've done, face the music. To face the music, he has to lose the music entirely so that he can stop drowning out these things that he's done. He turns himself in because he sort of starts to be like, you know, I am this person, you know, and I don't want to bring Deb down with me. Even though I think she debatably should have been arrested as well for aiding and abetting, but just the way that the movie continues on from that point, and he doesn't have headphones in jail, and he doesn't have headphones when Deb picks him up in the last scene. And that's just because he's sort of realizing that he's been using music to cover up some things that are, you know, difficult to deal with as a human, but you kind of have to eventually, like your mother's death and your father's death, but he really doesn't seem to care about his dad at all. It's kind of like a reverse Nolan where the dad doesn't care about the kids, but just as the movie progresses and he sort of starts to just pay more attention to what's going on around him instead of seeming to live his life in order to drown those things out.
Yeah, and that's why he only gets a 5-year sentence for something that, you know, really could have been a lot more, I think, is that those character witnesses that show up to his trial and say, you know, he apologized to me, and the woman at the post office saying he kind of signaled to me to get out of there. He has been a better person all along, but it's, as you said, facing the music and taking that full plunge and taking responsibility for your life and becoming an adult, everybody else who's going to be involved with your life, whether it's a partner or children or other members of your family, they are just dependent on you to be a good person, even if it's not in the way you act towards them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. One thing that I feel like we missed on discussing when we were talking about John Hamm is the way that I think the way his character turns and we start to realize just how bad he is. I think the way that is done is very, very subtle and good. You know, it's just sort of small incremental, turns and just the amount of time it takes for these things to happen. And the fact that, he actually like tries to be friends with Baby at the beginning when they're talking about music, and just that slow progression of Hamm becoming the big bad, I think was very good.
Yeah, it is pretty gradual because there's a point where, you know, maybe he's just a thrill seeker and Bats is truly insane. And then, yes, as you said, things definitely escalate beyond that point, and he ends up being the one to be concerned about.
Yeah, exactly. And as we're talking about other characters, you know, doing certain things to drown out the world around them, you know, he's a heavy drug user by the sounds of things. And Jamie Foxx, Bats, he gives, before each heist that they do, he gives a little speech that is just nonsense of basically him talking himself into believing that what he is doing is not horrible. And I just found that those examples existed outside of Baby's head was a nice touch as well. And you know, as the movie progresses and going with what we're talking about, John Hamm's heel turn, or at least from our perspective, heel turn, even though he's always a heel. When Baby learns, when Bats goes to steal gum and Baby learns that Buddy has stabbed multiple people for looking at Darling incorrectly, you know, he's not wearing headphones in that scene, you know, and it's just sort of these small things that happen when Baby's not wearing headphones, and these aren't things that we would think of to look at whether or not our main character's wearing headphones, because I don't think there's a movie that either of us has seen where a main character wears headphones more than this movie, you know. I just thought all those little things happen gradually, and a lot of them are just hard to pick up on just because you don't think to think, is my main character wearing headphones now?
Yeah, but it is so important. And I think that, you know, there's times that there's no music as well, because so much of the music we get is, you know, somewhat diegetic, somewhat through what we're experiencing is in an audio sense is what Baby is experiencing. And yeah, I just kind of want to know that if you think the music, you know, it's tough to talk about because it's so essential to the film. And I think that we've kind of said that some of the emotional stuff, runs dry, and it sounds like you at least value Baby's journey pretty much, but maybe not anything else. Do you think that the music's at all manipulative, like that this movie doesn't get emotion across well enough and relies on music to make us feel what we're supposed to feel? You know, because we've talked about movies that have no score and how that's so impressive sometimes, or have so little music that the filmmakers who are so confident and talented that they've put everything on screen that you're supposed to feel, and that they've done such a good job of conveying emotion that they don't rely on some guitar strings to swell up at the right moment. It's hard to talk about music being kind of overused or manipulative in this movie with, you know, 50 artists on the soundtrack. But I don't know if you put any thought into that.
Yeah, I definitely did. I guess my short answer to that question is no. I don't feel like it's overly manipulative because, I mean, just in the construction of the movie's manipulated around the music, you know? So, I guess I just sort of expected that going in. So I guess I just didn't think about it, but I never feel like, there just aren't emotional beats that I really feel in this movie, aside from ones that might be, you know, a bit abstract, but short answer is no. The long answer is continuing right now. It's just sort of like, I just sort of view this movie as, think of, I mean, this is a terrible example because it would change so much more about the movie, but think of like a musical equivalent like a strictly music equivalent of Abed from Community as Baby, you know? And this movie is basically the progression of somebody that has built their life, this expertly curated life that they keep in these 12 to 15 iPods that they have sitting around their house with all of Kid Koala's recording equipment, and just the way that you know they focus on media in general, and that they can only really engage with people that they don't know if that person pretty immediately starts talking about music in a very detailed way. And those two examples are Deborah and the woman that works at the post office. And this movie...
And Paul F. Tompkins talking about Farscape and Community.
Oh, yes, exactly. I was like, was PFT in this movie? Because Killer Mike and Big Boy Word, I missed that entirely. But yeah, and just the way that he's sort of coming to... terms with the idea that, you know, I think he's 21, he's supposed to be 21, there is a world to be lived outside of this music that he's got in his head. And while you can totally understand a child, you know, listening to music constantly to sort of drown out the constant reminder of his mother's tragic death and his father's slightly less tragic death, apparently. just the way that he is slowly coming to terms with the fact that you know, there's a world out there to live, and you know, just put the iPod down. I mean, maybe give me the iPod. I would love to have it. I find that as sort of the emotional thing that I find throughout the movie, as somebody choosing or realizing that there's a world outside of their music collection. And I do find that like mildly emotional arc. I think that works, despite the fact that I don't care for the actor that's going through it. And the way that, you know, it subtly progresses throughout the movie is that right before he turns himself in, right, he wakes up to that sound, that the tape that of his mother performing a version of Easy Like Sunday Morning. It seems like he doesn't listen to that tape very much. That's sort of the feeling I got. I'm curious to know if you feel the same way. Like, do you, I feel like he doesn't go home every night of the week and put that song on. Yeah.
No, and I don't think, I mean, I think he's capable of digitizing it and putting it on his iPod, and he hasn't. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and been walking around listening to it all the time.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so that, you know, that kind of goes into my point, that I feel like he doesn't listen to it because it's probably too painful for him. But Deb has put it on, right? And what she's doing is covering an older song, right? And so we've got Baby listening to a memory of his past, performing a memory of her past. And I mean, this movie is just a constant argument for the benefits of sampling. And that's what, you know, in a more human sense, you know, but by sampling, you know, you're keeping these elements of the past with you, which is exactly what you're doing when somebody that you love dies. You know, you just sort of, that there's part of them that's always with you, and you bring that into the future with you, whether you like it or not. And something he was doing was keeping the iPod, and now he's sort of moving forward because he realizes he has to get away from the life of crime, right? Because he feels like his mom wouldn't want him to be a criminal, and so he's able to move on by continuing to know that part of his past will always be with him, you know, that the tinnitus will always be in his ears. And I just think that that's interesting to me, you know. It's just choosing to move on because he started to realize that that aspect of the past that he's both trying to drown out and also keep with him at all times will always be there. You know?
Yeah, and I don't think it's really there, nor does it need to be. But when she describes that his mother has a beautiful singing voice, it doesn't seem to resonate with him that well. You know, it's not like he disagrees, but it's not maybe as sweet as you would think someone who loves music and clearly misses their mother very much. You know, in a way that might be, you could perceive that as like one of the nicest compliments, especially for someone like him, right? But I think he gets the idea that just as he can't experience the whole world with his earbuds in or try to shape his world to his music the way that the editing of this film does, he has to get past that. He has to think of his mother as a woman and a person who, you know, did so much. And I think it's, he kind of maybe perceives it as reductionary to say that that's all she was, you know, and Deborah has no way of knowing, you know, she wasn't around, but that his mother was more than someone with a beautiful singing voice and that she provided for him and loved him and took care of him. And that music, as important as it can be to that, to anybody, isn't that, you know, it's the people in your life. And I think that when he kind of, you know, we assume music's going to be a gigantic part of his life forever, but to see it kind of take that step downward into a very important art form and not the end all and be all of existence, I think is summed up there.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. And I feel like the trend of the idea of sampling is present in other elements of this movie as well. Like, I mean, aside from the obvious ones, but like the Run the Jewels, Danger Mouse, Big Boy song that's on the soundtrack samples the song from the opening scene of this movie, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, doesn't try to hide it at all. And we mentioned Walter Hill is in this movie as the voice of Joe, I believe his name is. And, you know, that's basically putting somebody that inspired this movie in this movie. You know, it's a sort of, it both places him, you know, it makes shows right paying homage to somebody that was influential in his life, and also makes Hill the voice of Baby Driver's guardian as well. So it's just sort of gives him this vaunted role, which is a nice touch as well.
Yeah, and the idea of you know, sampling and keeping something alive and expressing something that way. We'll talk about the iPod maybe just one more time.
I'm here all
but
day.
I think that's that music now is so easy to have such a wide variety, you know, with YouTube and just every streaming technology. Instead of listening to one album, and I know there's compilation albums and things like that, but just when you look at the wide variety of genres and artists and, I don't know, 60 years of music, that maybe a bit more, that we find on the soundtrack, music's very meaningful to him, but I think he's part of an age group that it was very easy to just listen to such a wide variety of music and express yourself or you know, ruminate on your feelings through listening to so many different types of music. And that's what it reminds me of when you talk about sampling, is taking all these things from the past and, you know, now there's just technology to do that so much more easily. And, you know, the idea of just doing sampling in general took a certain technological shift to make it first possible and second anywhere close to easy. And all those, you know, all that technology has continued to make something like this, something where you can have different iPods for different moods, where you can have a 2-hour movie with 50 different bands from 60 years of music that are all doing the same thing, that are all telling the same story and outlining Baby through all these different means, I think is something that comes across well with just the huge swath of music and music styles that come up in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. But it all goes back to the core of the movie. Like, this, the last scene of the movie, there is so little going on. It's a very simple scene of two people together, and it's Baby with the one person that who's still alive that he actually wants to spend any time with. And I think probably as far as outside of the action sequences of this movie, the best part of this movie for sure is the that moment when he envisions what his road trip with Deb is going to be like right before he sneaks out at 2 a.m. And just the way that it basically, like, it looks like a scene from the movie Pleasantville or something, you know, it's so idealized and specifically old fashioned. And we get a, the real life version of that, you know, like later in the movie. But Baby is imagining this sort of perfect world where, I don't know, he's just going on a road trip with the equivalent of the prom queen, and he's the high school quarterback, I suppose. And it's just sort of this very idealized version of the world that he has probably seen in a variety of different media products. And then 5 years later, he actually experiences the real world existence or version of that. You know, he's not wearing this perfect outfit. He is wearing a blue jeans and a white t-shirt with a breast pocket, which is a very 1950s outfit, but his hair isn't perfect. And Deb looks less done up than she did in the thing that he's envisioning. And
he's just had to go through 5 years of lockup.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it's just the color comes back into the image. It's like this idealized version still lacks a certain color, you know? And so when we get the real life version of it, we get to see it in color because this is actually the better version to have. It's the version that you can actually experience as opposed to the version that you can just watch. And it sort of completes Baby's arc as somebody that lives entirely inside his own head. And, you know, I feel like the last shot of this movie is meant to show us that Baby is entering the real world, you know?
Yeah, there's a world that you can experience instead of taking what you can through, you know, just through your ears and what other people have made and done.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Anything else about Baby Driver?
Baby Driver 2, starring Abed Nadir.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. Do you think there will be another one?
I would bet on it, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if Baby's deaf at the end of the movie. I don't think they make it clear that he's definitely not. Because he's clearly, you know, he touches the speaker. You could say that he just wants to, like, you know, that's the equivalent of him giving his mom a hug at this point. But it also is a callback to something that we saw Joe do because Joe can't hear. So I wonder if it's just sort of like a temporary loss of hearing, like a Stallone in Copland sort of situation, or just he is deaf because we don't see any proof that he's not, you know, even the guy that gives him the letter just hits him with it and says, here's a letter. It's not like Baby needs to hear that sentence to understand what's happening. And he stands in the courtroom, but he might, that's probably, you know, that's a formality. He may or may not be able to actually hear what's being said anyway.
So big cliffhanger for number two.
Well, I just feel like that's been an under-discussed element of this movie. Is Baby deaf at the end of the movie? You know?
Yeah, he does have two gunshots go off right next to his eardrums.
Yeah, I mean, the smart money's on, obviously, but also this movie doesn't exactly exist in reality, so anything's possible.
Well, and, I mean, outside of Copland, I don't think any movie depicts how loud gunshots actually are and how damaging they can be.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I hope there's a sequel, and I hope they find a way to bring back to life all the dead characters that I liked and get rid of one of them that I didn't.
Put it 40 years in the future when you can recast Baby and reanimating corpses is existing now.
But I still want Deb to be in the movie, so they do some creative sampling and keep her in the movie.
Sign me up.
All right. Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week.